From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lori Rubin is a musician, a gifted mezzo-soprano and a lyricist. She also designs jewelry. And what's particularly interesting about that is Lori is blind, which leads to the usual questions about how she manages shapes and colors without sight. And what she said is that our individual styles don't necessarily come from our visual experiences. It's hard to explain, but Rubin can sense colors and other experiences, and she can relate it all to other things, like music. For example, the color blue, she says, is like the note G major. Water skiing is like a fast movement of a Mozart piano sonata. Those are just some of the insights she's written and sung about. Rubin is in Utah this week performing, and she'll join us today after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It wasn't all that long ago that Lori Rubin was asked this question. It was after a rehearsal. Lori is a gifted mezzo-soprano. She's also blind. And the question wasn't all that original. In fact, she probably gets it all the time. Here it is. Do you dream in color? And as she tells it in her memoir, Rubin says it suddenly occurred to her, even as a grown woman who had already worked out many of the challenges and obstacles of being blind, it occurred to her she wasn't sure at the moment how to answer that question. Lori Rubin is in Utah this week. She's performing in Park City. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later in the program. But today in the program, she's joining us. Her book title asks that same question, Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. Lori has sung around the world, from Carnegie Hall to the Kennedy Center to stages in Rome and London. Along with her wife, Jenny Tyra, she is co-artistic director and co-founder of Ohana Arts. It's a performing arts group program in Hawaii where she and Jenny are based. And we should mention that Rubin is accompanied by Jenny on piano, performing in Park City, as I said. And Lori Rubin, welcome to you. Thanks very much for
being
with us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's great to be here.
I guess I wanted, this is one thing that occurred to me as I was thinking about the kinds of questions I could and should ask. What are the questions people are afraid to ask you because you're blind? You know what I mean? Is that a dumb question or an obvious question or an offensive question?
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I don't know. Sometimes, you know, the fact that they're not asking, I'm sure there's certain things that I never hear that are probably common thoughts that they're afraid to ask. But a lot of them are I think romance related. A lot of people are wondering how does a blind person have romance if you can't see?
Yeah.
I've been told that I would never have romance in my life when I was younger, and you know that was devastating to me. And of course that wasn't true. So nowadays I always tell girls, you know, whether blind or sighted, I always tell girls, you know, never listen to the naysayers. Always know who you are and believe in who you are. And the only person who can be the best you and who can make that happen is you. And, you know, so I'm trying to think. There are a lot of assumptions I know people have.
Yeah.
One of them that you're probably going to laugh is people assume blind people don't drink. Don't
really?
Swear, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, thanks for putting me on a pedestal, but I'm definitely not Mother Teresa, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a regular person. I just happen to not have working functional eyes. And I think it's kind of the same misconceptions people might have about celebrities that, you know, you just think, and it was funny, we were just talking about this morning with we were at breakfast with my dad and I was like, yeah, you know, they are just regular people too. And I just think that anytime somebody is different and does anything outside the norm or is anything outside of what their experience is, they tend to start putting you up on a different level.
Yeah.
And, I'm trying to think about the question.
Like it seems like they romanticize the idea of being blind too in some way. Like, and there's this thing that you write in your book about the fact that the things that you have learned is that a lot of the stuff that you hadn't done very well, at least at first, wasn't necessarily related to the fact that you couldn't see, but was your lack of experience.
Exactly. And interesting you mentioned that because A few years ago, I went with Jenny and her family to Sun River, Oregon, which is beautiful. It's not dissimilar from Park City, and there's a lot of biking and hiking, and it's just gorgeous. And Jenny wanted to go bike riding, and I said, hey, let's try to find a tandem bike. And so we did. And then I was like, oh, gosh, now I have to do it. Right. And I was so terrified. And the funny thing was, we, you know, on the count of three, we tried to pedal together, you know, and just taking that leap of faith and knowing that we were, it was up to me and her to keep ourselves balanced, scared me so much. And I remember, so the first time it didn't work out because I was too chicken. And I was so mad at myself. And then the next day, we just did it, and I finally just said, okay, this is trust. And I realized it wasn't a blindness thing. Mm. It was any other person would have had that. And then the funny thing was that Jenny's sister and her friend tried the tandem bike, and they tried, you know, even with their eyes, normally working eyes, they were like, no, I can't do this. I can't do this. And they didn't end up getting going. And I thought, okay, my being afraid had really nothing to do with being blind. It was just, as you said, lack of experience.
So I want to go back to that question that you were asked. This was Katya was this girl's name. She was 10 years old at the time, and she asks you this question. Now, you must have gotten the question before, yes?
Yeah.
Do you dream in color? Mm-hmm. But what was it about that particular moment that made you start thinking maybe differently about the question?
To be honest, it was just the fact that I was working on this book.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, it was so funny because at the time, I didn't know what I wanted the book to be about. But it was on my brain that I had to start thinking of a narrative, something to tie it together, something poetic that would give the book some sort of direction and some sort of dramatic arc and things. And when Katya asked that question, a few days later, her dad asked me to write a poem, and he's a composer. He's the one who asked me to do that concert.
Right.
And so Katya's dad said, you know, why don't you write a poem about your life as a blind person? And I thought, oh, gosh, anything I write is going to be so corny and so cheesy. And it's just what you said about people are always thinking about romanticizing blindness. And I didn't want to do that. But I guess Katya's question stuck in my head. And I thought, okay, Do You Dream in Color could be a really nice leitmotif for a poem about my life as a blind person. It could be a question that keeps coming up and me answering it in different ways, both figurative and literal. But the exciting thing about that question for me is also that I could turn it back on a naysayer, because I thought to myself, well, it's very rare that I'll have the opportunity to tell the world in a nutshell what my life is like. So I start The first one is somebody asked me, do you dream in color? And I start talking about makeup and putting on makeup and things like that. And the second is somebody at a bead store, and I start talking about jewelry and how I make jewelry and how that works out for me. And then the third is a girl like Katya. I guess that would be the Katya in that scenario. And I'm signing her program, and she says, do you dream in color? And then she starts telling me what color means to her.
Yeah.
And then the fourth gives me the opportunity to be like, listen, do you dream in color? Because it's somebody saying to me, well, you know, you're not being you've got to be realistic about your life. You're going to have limitations. And then I go off about, well, actually, you know, people are asking me, do you dream in color? But then I have to go back and ask them, how do they dream? Do they really dream? Do they dream past their limitations?
Right. I want to come back to that poem, actually, because you've put it to music. And I want to play some of it a little bit later in the program. Let me back up, though. I want you to tell this story that you relate in the book. You're, I think, around 4 years old. You're pretty young. And there's this really interesting experience you have with your brother, Brian. And Brian is reading this book. He's reading Watership Down. It's a great book.
Yeah.
And tell this story, because what happens, I'm not confused by it, but it's so interesting that you don't get that. It's not like you don't get that you're blind, but I mean, this is such an interesting. Tell the story first, because I want to talk about it.
Totally. Okay, so in this story, and so what happens is that my brother's reading a book, and I'm sitting on the floor playing or whatever, and he's turning pages, and you know the sound of it is so ethereal to me that I turn to him and I say, "What are you doing?" Not that I haven't heard people turn pages of a book before, but it's always a sound that's fascinated me.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to do what he did. So he says, well, I'm reading. And I said, oh, and at 4 years old, I was kind of young to be reading to myself anyway. I felt picture books and things like with raised pictures, but I'd never actually read.
Right.
So I said, oh, I want to do it too, because I wanted to do everything he did. And so I begged him to like let me read the book. And he said, no, but you can't. You're too young. And I was like, no, too young. And that was the wrong thing for him to say. That was my trigger. So I said, let me see it. So he reluctantly handed me the book.
Yeah.
And I'm touching the pages going, he's fibbing me because there's nothing on these pages. It was blank.
That's crazy.
So I'm
That's so interesting.
And I'm like turning the pages and going, well, how? What does he do? So I'm like, how are you reading? I don't get it. And he's like, well, you can't see. That's why you don't see what's on the page. And I was like, what do you mean? They're blank. So to me, even though I knew I was different and I knew I was blind, I didn't know exactly what that meant because I'd never experienced sight, right?
Yeah.
Except
yeah.
for the ability to see light.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was, it was interesting. And then there was another experience which got edited out of the book where I'm sitting in the car and I was bored. And my mom said, I said, how long are we going to be till our next destination or wherever it was? I think we were on our way to Lake Tahoe. And then she's telling me what the things that she's seeing out the window. And she said, yeah, if you look out the window, there's trees and there's cars and there's this and there's that. And I went and touched the window. I remember touching the window and thinking, how is there a way to see out of it, you know? So there have been several occasions that I remember being young and wondering what I was missing, you know. But it was never a negative thing. It was just kind of
It wasn't a negative thing.
Yeah.
So that's a question I have to ask. When Brian says to you, he says, look, Laurie, you're touching those pages, you're not seeing them. And you say, what do you mean seeing them?
Mm-hmm.
When the realization finally dawns on you that Brian's perceiving this book in a different way, you didn't see that as a negative thing?
I think I was jealous because I knew he could do something that I couldn't. And that was to me, and that was, there was a time that he wanted to play, he used to play ping pong with my family, my parents or whoever was around. And I was mad that they wouldn't let me play ping pong. But then they let me and I realized within 2 minutes that I couldn't do it, you know, and I was like, oh, okay, that's what it's all about. And when I realized that there was a logistical reason, it wasn't personal, I was fine with it. And I think it was the same thing with seeing. It was like, oh, it's just something I'm not able to do. And it's just, it has nothing to do with me per se. It's just a function of my situation.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I never took it as negative. And I think also the reason I never took it that way is that my family, from the time I was 9 months old, always wanted me to go everywhere and do everything that the rest of my family was doing. And that's why as a kid, I went skiing, I went snow skiing, water skiing, river rafting. There was never an experience that I was left out of. Until I got into middle school, that's a whole other bag of tricks.
Yeah,
there.
It is. Which will, I'm afraid I want to spend a little bit of time with that. But let's talk about music because I get a sense that there was a lot of music at home when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. My dad used to, when he would ever, he's a gadget person, so whenever he liked to buy new speakers and things, and he would always find that classical music was, at the time, the best thing to showcase the sound of the speakers. It was the most wide-angle sound that you could get, you know. And so I think that's why I always really loved classical music, because it was always around. And when I was in elementary school, I had a music teacher that would play things like Peter and the Wolf. And the reason I started to get to know the different instruments and how they were played is because of that piece, because Peter and the Wolf, it's all about how each instrument is personified by a different character. So, for example, Peter is the strings and the wolf is the horns and such on. And then my teacher, the same teacher, had each of us handle and try to play every instrument. So it would be, we would try the brass, we would try clarinet, we would try flute, violin. I remember we had the whole semester on the violin and I was like, yeah, I'm definitely not a violinist.
Right.
But at least I knew that when an orchestra was playing, what exactly was happening and how they were playing each instrument. And I think my teacher felt that since we would never see that, and to us, it would just sound like a live version of a radio broadcast. She wanted us to visualize what was happening on stage.
Yeah. But you were blind.
Exactly.
So how could you visualize what was happening on stage?
Well, I think that's just it. Like the fact that this teacher had me experience what it's like to hold a violin with a bow or I was fascinated by the flute because you had to make noise, almost like making noise with a Coke bottle, which I was never very good at. But I was really, really determined to make a sound off of on the flute. And then I started to get a feel for like the fast movement on the keys. And the conductor, you know, the one thing I didn't see was the conductor. But I did have enough, I guess, information to know what was happening when an orchestra was playing, enough to be really impressed and to be fascinated by how a big sound could be created by all these individual instruments that I had once had in my hand.
Yeah.
That was pretty amazing.
So I don't want to keep romanticizing blindness, but I do want to ask it did occur to me that not being able to see, did that make you experience music more intensely?
Mm.
You know what I mean?
You know, it's hard for me to say only because I've never I've never had sight.
Yeah, of course.
I've had friends tell me who have had things like retinitis pigmentosa where they've lost their sight, where they do feel that because they're not seeing, they have a more intense experience with the world because they never realized how much they were hearing or smelling or touching or tasting. So their other senses became things that they paid more attention to. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's really funny. People ask me, "Why is it you're like a bat? Like, do you have like sonar? Or And I'm like, "No. I think what it is that your other, you know, people give a lot of credit to their sight, but what they don't realize is that all five senses are working in harmony. So what you think you might be seeing, you're actually also hearing, mm-hmm. smelling, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think the way I answer that is that it's just I'm using my other senses in the same way and possibly more than people with sight. But I don't think I have an extra sense in a way that people think that I do. The one exception to that is that I think when somebody's upset or somebody's feeling a certain way, I definitely think that I'm noticing more. I can hear it. There was one time we had I don't know if my dad even remembers this, but there was this gentleman who we had a friend who was in the jewelry business, and my parents were at their country club because they played golf, and we were having lunch after they played golf, and this guy Steve, this guy in the jewelry business, came up and said hi, and I don't know why, I was a teenager, and I said to him, "What's wrong?" And it opened up the floodgates, and he was talking about something that happened in business that was really really worrying him. And after that, my mom said, "How did you know? He was smiling. How did you know there was something wrong?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, you could totally hear it in his voice, you know?" Yeah. So maybe it's that. But I think that if people were more tuned in to their other senses, they would have felt it too. It's just that they're so busy, you know, looking at stuff, which is not a problem. I mean, I would do the same thing if I had sight. So,
when did people figure out you had perfect pitch? When did you figure that out?
So when I was 4 years old or so, I would play the piano. I had a piano teacher, and when she told me middle C was middle C, I thought just like learning the alphabet, you just memorize the sound and associate it with a note. So yeah. I never even thought twice about not memorizing what C would sound like. And, you know, so anyway, I didn't really realize that was anything unusual until I went to a Kenny Loggins concert. And Kenny Loggins was a good friend of the family's, and that's a whole other story in the book.
Which I want to talk about too, by the way.
Okay, so, but when I was at one of his concerts, I had said to him, you sang Meet Me Halfway in E-flat today. How come you didn't sing it in E? Because I was genuinely curious why. And Kenny looks at me and he goes, shh, don't say anything. Because I guess his voice was feeling a little bit, I don't know if he was under the weather, but he didn't want people to know that it was in a different key. Yeah. And that's how I found out I had perfect pitch, because he said that's an unusual thing. And that's when that came out.
When did so you were probably a typical kid in the sense that you listened to a lot of pop music.
I did.
Right. Uh-huh. So when does opera occur to you? Like, when does opera become a part of your life?
Opera was always something that was part of my life since I was born, because my grandparents always listened to it. Mm. And I'd go to their house all the time, you know, as a kid, because we were very close. And they would play videos of Carmen, or most of the stuff they played was actually in German, because they loved Strauss and that kind of stuff. But I used to listen to it. And so I would imitate the singers just instinctively, just kind of like sing along, more like wail along or whatever. And my grandmother said, "Oh, Lori, you know, you should take lessons, because it sounds like you could do opera."
Yeah.
And when I was playing piano, I loved it, but I was never patient enough to... I wanted to play like the pros, but I was never patient enough to actually practice and learn and, get the finesse at all. So when my pianist would be playing stuff that she'd want me to learn, I would just be harmonizing or singing along. And she'd be like, "Yeah, I think voice is your instrument." And that's how I got into singing. And of course, by default, I did pop music. So I started with Memory, and I started because I loved Barbara Streisand. And then I did Wind Beneath My Wings, because of course that was big at the time. I was like 11.
Yeah.
And then I went to see Phantom of the Opera. And that kind of changed my entire life because it, you know, even though it's a musical, the whole thing is about opera. So I got really just transfixed by this whole world that you get taken to in this musical. And instead of saying to my teacher, oh, I want to be a musical theater singer, I said, oh, I want to do opera.
Yeah.
And so that's how I started to get into it.
You went to Oberlin School, which was, this was an important, I think, place for you because of the way you started then to develop your own sort of self-perception of, as a person being blind. And
right.
I want to ask you about, I've heard you sing a performance of Rossini's Cinderella.
Mm-hmm.
And you sang this in college, right?
Mm-hmm.
At Oberlin. And it's an interesting story that you tell in the book about the director sort of wondering how we're going to use this blind girl for this lead role. You do end up getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have talked about how you created this interpretation where blindness makes the character Cinderella different and richer. Would you tell that story?
Yeah, well, and I'll start by saying that I was really resistant to my director's idea because he wanted me to literally walk around the stage with a broom because Cinderella obviously has a broom all the time, sweeping because she's a housekeeper for her, you know, her sisters and her father and the father in the show, stepfather. But he wanted me to use it like a cane. And I don't know, I just felt like that was so cheesy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when it comes down to it, even though he's the director, I felt like, oh, this is me on stage, you know, and I don't want to be portraying these awful things. And he wanted me to wear dark glasses.
Yeah.
And
what was that about, by the way? That was weird.
The dark glasses?
Yeah, because you don't wear dark glasses.
I don't, but I guess people think of people who do. I mean, I think Stevie Wonder does.
You know, of course, but you don't. So why do you want you to?
I don't know. Because, you know, my eyes are not something I ever felt like I wanted to hide.
Yeah.
I just, because I didn't really care. I just wanted to be myself. And also because I see light, so I never wanted to obstruct that.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to explain that to my director. He's like, yes, but the audience, it won't read. It won't read. You need to put on the glasses. And also you can take them off later because it's like you're getting rid of this stereotype. But in the end, I think when I actually did do the interpretation, because I wasn't going to make a big stink about it. I didn't want to be the difficult diva. I think what happened was that I really felt like my life was, in a sense, like Cinderella. Mm-hmm. I had great parents and I had a great family and relatives and friends. But when I was in high school and middle school, I felt so different and isolated. And I was bullied, but not in the way like I was never beaten up, but I was what you call, I guess the psychologists call passive aggressively bullied, which means that I was ignored. I was sort of purposely not invited to parties. I was, you know, sometimes like there was one kid that would come up in front of me and pretend to trip me and I didn't see it. And then and then he'd move his foot out of the way when I would get closer. And then I found out about it because somebody else would be seeing it. And then, you know, so at school, I felt like Cinderella.
Yeah.
And then but when I got to college and people celebrated me for who I was and being blind wasn't a big deal. And in fact, this is really funny, but the more different you were, the more popular you were.
Right.
So being blind made me like, you know, kind of, you know, the person in the conservatory that people were fascinated by.
Yeah.
And then being able to have great friends and for people not to care about those kinds of things. And then there was one rehearsal where the stepfather beats up Cinderella and says, oh, of course you can't go to the ball. Who do you think you are? And her this man who is in the sense the fairy godfather, but he's actually just somebody from the prince's court. He says, you know, he ends up taking her to the ball and he says the good will triumph and he puts her in a dress, you know, gives her a dress. And during that scene, I just started like sobbing uncontrollably. And I realized it was because, and it was only in rehearsal that I was sobbing. I wasn't like a nut on stage, but what I realized was that, you know, this really is what my experience was, exactly what her experience was. And that here I was going into this opera after being told in middle school that I would never have a normal life. And, you know, so I'm not even sure if it's blindness that made the experience richer or just my personal experience of life made the show richer. But whatever it was, it definitely made me feel like I could relate and own the character.
Lori Rubin is with us. Her memoir is called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. On Saturday night at 7 o'clock, she's going to be performing at the Promontory Amphitheater in Park City. The event is free. You need to RSVP, though, to get in. There's a phone number and an email on our website, radiowest.org. Heading into this break, you'll hear Lori Rubin singing that aria from Cinderella. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Non più mezzo gatto il fuoco, starò sola gorgheggiar no. A fun lampo sogno gioco il mio lungo palpitar.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Lori Rubin. She's performing this weekend in Park City. It gives us a chance to talk to her about how she navigates her life as a blind person, how she perceives the world, what she means when she says she's always experienced color in her life. Her memoir is Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. She's going to be performing in Park City Saturday night at 7 o'clock. There's details on our website. We'll get back to it a little bit later on the program. So I wanted to ask you, let's come back to Kenny Loggins, because I noticed like in the acknowledgement section, I think it is, mm-hmm. and you refer to Kenny Loggins as your first music teacher. Would you say something more about that? Because I actually want to ask about this experience you have water skiing with Kenny Loggins, which sounds pretty great.
That was awesome. Yeah, it was great. Well, I think what I meant by that was that he didn't, you know, actively sit down and teach me, but when I was young, I was listening to his music because my mom liked his music, and she met him at the supermarket and told him, you know, about her 4-year-old blind daughter. And of course, you know, I guess he had a soft heart, so he gave us backstage passes to his next concert at the amphitheater, and it was my first concert. So that in itself was a eye opener and a lesson. And I remember how loud it was. I was like, wow, it's so much louder than it is on the CD on the record at the time. And so we're, you know, backstage at meeting him and talking to him, and I had all these questions for him about harmony and how does he harmonize with himself. But, you know, of course, I never asked because I was too shy. But over the years, we got to know him so well because we just kept coming back to his concerts. We kept going backstage. My dad ended up sort of taking photos for him, and you know, they collaborated on a couple of projects. A Christmas Unity telethon that Kenny was hosting, and my dad donated all sorts of toys for that. And so we just developed a really strong friendship over the years. And as such, we got to go to some pretty cool events, and we also got to see him in the recording studio. And I just learned a lot about music just by observing and being around all of his musicians. And eventually I sang on one of his albums because my brother and I were asked to join a children's choir.
Yeah.
And so I got to actually sing a couple of songs. And on one of them, he was looking for scat solos, like just little things that you barely hear in the background. But, you know, he asked me to do one. And so as the song, If You Believe, on his album, Leap of Faith, as it sort of fades out, you can sort of hear me a little bit.
Really?
It's like, oh, there's
pretty cool.
That thing. I thought maybe something. But yeah, no, it was just really great. And, you know, we would go skiing with him and snow skiing up in Lake Tahoe. He would do concerts at Caesar's Palace. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time there. And one time we went water skiing with Kenny. He had a sort of a party, and some of his band members and his groupies were there. And so we were on a speedboat with Kenny. And, you know, as I said, I never wanted to not do what the other people were doing.
Yeah.
If I was the only one, like I'd always question why that was.
Yeah.
And my brother was water skiing, and I was like, I want to go too. And Kenny heard me say that. So he got a ski instructor on board, and that was my water skiing experience. Was the guy, you know, put me in the water, put some skis on me, and
you got up for a while.
Yeah, I got up for, I don't know how long it was. Could be 10 seconds, could be 30. It felt like forever. And
but what's cool about this story, because you tell this in the book, is I think it was your brother, Brian, who said, how is it that you did that?
Mm-hmm.
And you said this in the book. You said that it wasn't about seeing. It was about feeling
yes.
the water.
Yeah,
what
absolutely.
Do you mean?
Yeah, well, because I think especially with, well, snow skiing is one thing because you do have to see where you're going. And that's why I have a ski guide saying right, left. Oh, I mean, right, you know. and we've had a couple of mishaps. But with water skiing, it really isn't about seeing. You're holding on to, the boat is your guide. And you're holding on to this little, I don't know, tube thing or handle that's attached to this boat that's kind of several feet, you know, away from you. And so it's all about trusting your kinesthetic awareness and trusting your body and knowing exactly which muscles pull you up and how you stay up. And to me, water skiing is all about physical sensation. It's not about what you're seeing. I think, if anything, you what you're seeing when you're water skiing is more like the view, or, you know, you're like, oh, there's some fish over there, or whatever it is. But to me, it's the actual sport of it is all about what you feel in your body. And I would imagine athletes would tell you that. In a lot of cases that you do have to see for certain things, but for a lot of it, you have to rely on your awareness of your body.
There's this story you tell in the book about becoming addicted to the show Sex and the City. Your mom kept trying to talk you into seeing it.
Yes.
And, I don't really want to see it. And then you got hooked once you did. And I wanted to ask you about this because you say that you found yourself, this is how you put it in the book, you found yourself wanting to experience beauty like those ladies on the show. So explain that. You wanted to know, you say, how to make visual statements about yourself. I mean, you're really into fashion. What do you mean? Why is that important, the idea of making visual statements?
Okay. Well, I guess I should start by saying that when I was in high school, I was not exactly a sight for sore eyes. I mean, I would wear like the same t-shirts every day. Like, I didn't care at all.
Why? Because you figured you were blind, it didn't matter in some way?
Also because I was almost rebelling against this whole popular girl structure thing.
Yeah.
And they cared about how they looked, so I didn't want to.
Yeah, sure.
But I think also blindness played a big part of that, because I obviously, if I could see, then I would probably have all those influences and I'd feel like I had to fit in and I had to do this. So I just was like totally resistant to that whole thing. Partly is because I just thought they were shallow and mean and stuff like that. And you know, I say that now, but you know, of course we're all adults and I would, you know, I don't harbor any, you know, ill will towards any of those, you know, it's just how you are in seventh grade.
Sure.
But when I was in grad school, or maybe just a slightly before, my mom, we were like in the middle of nowhere, literally, because I was about to go to this summer program in near Buffalo. And there was nothing to do, so we watched Sex and the City. And I think what it was that my mom was starting to describe all these outfits that Sarah Jessica Parker was wearing. Mm-hmm. And to me, it wasn't just like she's wearing this blue sweater and it matches this cute little skirt. It was like she's wearing a turquoise slip dress with a red apple necklace and these crazy heels that are in the shape of butterflies or whatever. You know, I don't know. I'm just exaggerating. But,
sure.
But to me, I thought, okay, now, this is not to me just about fashion or just wearing LV, which was kind of my sense of what the popular girls, you had to wear certain, you know, accessories and you had to wear the certain outfits and certain purses and stuff. But what to me was going on was that she was making a work of art of her wardrobe and of herself. Mm. And I thought, how cool is that? And it made me realize that there was this whole side of myself that had sort of been lying dormant, that I knew was there. And that I always, you're going to, might think this is funny, but I always felt that I was a visual artist that had not found her medium yet. Wow. And so when I started watching that show, I started getting much more interested in using my appearance as a way to sort of display who I am. And so that's when I got really into makeup, and I got really into different clothes and the different textures and jewelry.
Okay, so here's the question, though. I hope this isn't a dumb question.
No, not at all.
So when you're blind, how is it that you evaluate? Like for a lot of us, we are, when we're establishing our own sort of style, a lot of it is based on what we're seeing, right? Oh, I really like the way that thing fits and the flow of that and the texture of that and the color of that. How is it different when you can't see? Like, how do you evaluate? How does it change your sense of fashion? Is your sense of fashion less dependent on the stuff everyone else is wearing and your own sense of yourself?
I think it's a bit of both. I think what you're saying about, I love how this fits and I love the cut. And I think there's definitely you can feel that when a piece of clothing is on you.
Yeah, totally.
And you can feel how, like, it really flatters your body.
Yeah.
And you can feel when it totally doesn't.
Right.
So there's that. And for me, it's also like, I love when there's a bohemian kind of look to a shirt where it looks like the back of it is a regular t-shirt that somebody cut apart. And then they add like a big chiffon piece that might you might find on a dress, or and the sleeves are totally different, and they're like bell cut, you know, bell. What is that called? I don't know. They're very just like flowy sleeves or whatever it is. Yeah. So that might be just one example. So to me, it makes a statement because it shows that, you know, they're putting this artist is putting several different kinds of ideas together and marrying them into one piece. And then, yeah, I guess for me, I'm not really into, okay, well, people are wearing this kind of style, therefore I have to.
Yeah.
And for example, I have a cousin who used to be really into these like Helen Ficalora charms. And they're these really cute little, you know, you can get a paw print, or you can get your name or whatever. And I was like, that's okay. I already have the Tiffany tag bracelet. I don't need to get this Helen Ficalora thing. You know, it's the same thing. So those kinds of things I never got into that kind of thing. Like, I have to wear this exact thing. But there was one, you know, Jenny, my wife at the time when we were first getting to know each other, she did make fun of me because I used to have, reverse jeans. I don't know if you even remember that term, but they're like the MC Hammer look. Like, they taper at the bottom.
Yeah.
And for years I just wore them because they were comfortable, like loose fit Gap jeans, you know, reverse jeans.
Right.
And she's like, no, they haven't been in since the early 90s. You really have to go and get, I don't know, at the time the flare was in, the boot cut was in.
Yeah.
So, you know, those kinds of things, obviously I wouldn't know that I was wearing something that was totally out of fashion. But on the other hand, I think that fashion for me, you can tell a lot by touch, like feeling what's on you. And to me, like it's really funny. Sometimes I'll pick out something and Jenny's like, oh, I didn't even see that. I like that. Or, you know, And it's all about what it feels like on the mannequin or on the hanger.
You design jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked about, you know, finding the right textures and identifying the right colors. And this, you said something that was so interesting and I wanted to, and maybe it was just an offhanded thing, so maybe I'm making too much of it. But you mentioned this in the book too, that you use a visual sense of color that you may have inherited from a past life.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you mean?
So, you know, the funny thing is that when people say blue, I visualize blue, and I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
But blue comes to mind, and I'm not sure if it's a visual thing or what, but for some reason, I feel like I know what blue is, like I'm familiar with it, or red or green or what have you. And I think when I say that about a past life is because that's the only thing I can think of that would give me such a close sense of a color without seeing it.
Yeah.
The other thing is probably, too, that I've, you know, associated colors with music. So, for example, blue, like an ocean blue reminds, I always think of the Mixolydian mode, which when you're thinking of these medieval musical modes, that's so like totally nerdy, but it's the G major scale, but there's no F sharp. That's the Mixolydian mode.
Right.
And so it's just a regular F natural. So to me, that's what the like a lighter or a deeper ocean blue is. But then when you get into the darker blue, I think of G minor.
Mm-hmm.
And then A major to me is green, but F sharp minor is yellow. And B flat for some reason reminds me of chocolate, and I'm not sure if it's because I was watching some TV show with a theme song that was in B flat while I was eating an ice cream bar or something.
Right.
But you know, so it's hard to say why different colors resonate for me, and I think a lot of it is life experience. Like autumn is, you know, I think of autumn and I think of autumn colors, but I also do have this crazy suspicion that maybe I did see color once in another a time that I obviously don't remember.
or also that we humans have embedded in our brains this concept of color, whether we can see it or not, you think, in some way?
That's interesting, maybe. And that also leads me to, you know, sometimes I've asked what color something is, and somebody will tell me purple, and then I'll ask somebody else about the same item, and they'll say, oh, it's a dark blue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're right that everybody's brain thinks of colors in a certain way, and it may not always be the same. But we do have an idea of color, whether it's what is visually in front of us or not.
Here's a question that comes from Ryan, who writes, beyond dreaming in color, have you ever dreamt imagery? That is, have you seen definitive figures like people or animals or shapes from your imagination?
Ah, interesting. See, now I've always expected that question. Which, do you dream in color? To me, almost skips a step because it's like,
right.
Why would you, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's great that people ask it. But yeah, the question that Ryan, that you're asking, I think I what I explain to people is I dream exactly what I experience in my real life, because dreams are just an offshoot of your life experiences. Yeah. And you might dream something that you don't normally do, like fly, but your body imagines what flight feels like because you've had that sensation like from jumping or falling or whatnot that you would know what flying feels like. But for me, I don't dream images because I haven't seen them. I might dream light in a certain way. And in fact, I have had dreams where I see kind of magical looking light, but that's because I see light. But the dream that always comes to mind when I think of that question is when my book was ready to go, was ready for an agent, and I remember shopping different agents. I remember having a dream being in an agent's office and, you know, sitting in a chair, and I remember the acoustics of the office and the light. But it was like I was physically there. So I didn't dream as if I was looking at it through a television aerial, but rather being there, you know, with, you know, who I am without really seeing full, you know. It's not like all of a sudden I could look out the window and there were aliens in the sky or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think it's a really good question. And it's one I probably wouldn't even have thought about until, you know, somebody asked about it.
Laurie Rubin is with us. She's the author of the book, Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. This Saturday night at 7 o'clock, she's going to be performing her solo show at the Promontory Amphitheater. It's in Park City. She's going to be accompanied by her wife, Jenny Tyra. The concert is free. You have to RSVP in advance, though, and you can call 818-424-3919 or just go to our website. We have other particulars there, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Laurie Rubin. We're talking about her life and her work. She has a memoir called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. She's going to be performing this weekend in Park City, Saturday night. We have particulars on our website. We'll have a few more details a little bit later in the program. I wanted to ask you, did being blind in any way complicate another reality of your identity, and that is that you're gay?
Oh, that's so interesting you asked that. I think in a way, I don't think it complicated my process, but I think it complicated, you know, it goes along with the whole drinking thing. People would never assume that a blind person would. And I think it's because for, you know, especially in the 90s, even people who were gay, you know, people always sort of thought of it as a sexually deviant thing. You know, it's even though it's not, I mean, it's just another way you're wired.
Right.
It was always something, you know, different and off the beaten path and alternative and whatnot. So I had this really good friend who is now, I mean, she's one of my closest friends in the world. And when I first met her, I knew somebody, a friend of mine had told me about her. And she's like, oh, my God, Laurie, you have to meet her. And you know, she's like, you guys are both gay and da, da, da. So when I met her, she was actually my student. It was really funny because I was a voice major at Yale.
Yeah.
And or I was in the opera program, and but I taught other students in the music in the School of Music voice lessons who were on other, who were taking other instruments. For example, this girl, this friend of mine, Killin, was a trombone student, but I taught her voice lessons. And so she comes in for her lesson, and she came in, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, she's so painfully shy. And so I started talking to her and trying to break the ice, and I mentioned my girlfriend at the time, and she was just like, all of a sudden, she could be herself. And she's like, you know, later, like a lot later, she told me, you know, I never thought you would be gay, too. She's like, somehow, you know, I just knew that you were blind and I didn't know what to say and I didn't know what to do. Right. And somehow, you know, the gay thing really broke the ice. And so in a way, I think in a way it helped me make friends because there was something else that I had in common with somebody. So it was like if they had questions about if they didn't know how they could relate to me, they knew they could start by relating to me in that way. There have been times, though, people have said things like, oh, well, of course it makes sense that you'd like girls because you can't see. So therefore, you'd like probably anybody that's nice to you. And I was like,
that's so weird.
And I was like, no, it doesn't really work that way. You know, because you feel a vibe, you feel an attraction. It's a chemical thing.
Yeah.
I didn't even know how to respond to that. I think I was completely speechless when somebody said that to me. But to me, it really hasn't been a problem in any way.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you write in the book that about, for example, how Jenny is sometimes seen when you guys are together. Like, she's your helper. She's the helper. She's maybe part of the wait staff. Like, when she's around, she's like, would you go get me some water?
It's frustrating.
Yeah. But at one point, you say in the book that Jenny says to you, look, Laurie, it's partly because we're gay.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, so you're gay and blind and with an Asian American woman.
Yes. Okay.
So you got a lot going on.
That, you know, my brother once told me, he's like, you know, God has a really interesting sense of humor. He said, you know, you're, Jewish, blind, gay, lesbian, woman, you know, like, come on, how many more minorities could we put in there? I was like, okay, black, I don't know, Asian, I don't know, whatever. But, you know, I remember thinking that was really funny, and I think I put it somewhere in the book. But I've totally forgot about that. Like, to me, that's true. You know, Jenny and I always talk about that. Like, if she were a man, people would just assume, they probably would make some horrible other assumptions, but they would always treat her like the man. Yeah. You know, I'm glad she's not a man. But I think what's hard is that there's stereotypes to Asian women because in the healthcare industry, a lot of the people assume that a lot of the caretaking people are going to be Asian. In LA, we have, for some reason, there's a lot of people in that industry who are Filipino. I'm not sure why. And I don't think it's all over, but I do think, you know, people have that stereotype. So I think we are fighting that a lot. We always joke when we go to airports. People think that she's doesn't speak English, and they think I'm mute, which is, I don't know why that is. So they start talking in caveman, and they start pointing. or, you know, like you said, like the other day, like we were working with somebody, a photographer, and he started talking to her. He didn't even say please. He said, get this, do that, do da da, you know. And, you know, she's the, and this was for, you know, for something that has something to do with Peace on Your Wings, with our musical that we've written.
Yeah.
So, which is, I know, a later conversation. But anyway, but it's just like she wasn't even in the context of even being a, quote, you know, wife or anything. This was like we were collaborators, and they still treated her like that. And I do think that, yes, people assume that she, no matter, even if we're colleagues, that she always has to take care of me or something. And even though I'm always doing things for myself, I just always have to fight against that stereotype. And I want to fight that for her, because I don't ever want her to feel, or anyone to feel, that we are different, you know, that our positions are different, that she has to take care of me. Living in New York and having a doorman was really interesting, because they would always, if I came with her with bags of groceries, and they would always take, even if I was carrying the lightest thing, they would take the lightest thing out of my hand, and Jenny would be like waddling with five bags of groceries, and they would totally ignore her. So it's just like, it's frustrating, and we still have to deal with that. And I hate it. I think it's demoralizing. I always say, like, if I were a man, it would feel like I'd have my balls cut off. You know, it's just really, you never want to be, you know, the one thing I think everybody wants is dignity. And I think in a lot of times in my life, I've been treated without dignity. And that's never, I always want my autonomy, and I always want people to treat me like a regular person.
What is the relationship like, like the working relationship between you and Jenny? You collaborate now with music. She writes the music, you do the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe that relationship?
It's wonderful. It's fabulous. I mean, it's complicated by the fact that we are also married.
Yeah.
So there's the personal stuff that gets involved, like, oh, you don't like this, or what, you know, because there's always that, you treat family differently than you would say probably treat, you know, a professional collaborator that you don't have a friendship or relationship with. But at the same time, I think it makes our music really special and personal. And, you know, I always tell people that, you know, eventually, of course, we do want to have kids. But to me, our music feels like a child because it's something we both created together. And when we actually wrote, we've written quite a few songs together that they were so hard to write that I always say that it's like going through labor. Yeah. It's like when it finally comes out, it's like, oh, look what we just given birth to, you know? So it is a really special, wonderful relationship. I also, you know, I think both of us sometimes also dread the moments when we have to do it because it's like we're worried about what the other of us is going to think and mm-hmm. how we're going to react to each other just, you know, because of that. But I think that's something that I hear universally across the board. The Lopez Anderson duo, they wrote Frozen, and I listened to a podcast of theirs on NPR. And boy, did they have the exact same comments about their relationship, about how fabulous it is to work together, and how it's complicated by the fact that they're married. And for us, so basically what happens is that, well, for the first song that we ever wrote together, we had talked about it. And because she knows me, so, Jenny knows me so well, you know, she started asking, and Jenny also has really, really, really good ideas. I always say that she's the idea person, and I'll just sell it, you know, like I'm the salesperson.
Right.
So I'll write some lyrics, and then she'll look at them, and then she'll start writing music, and then we'll start working together on the general form of the song. Like if there's too many lyrics, we'll be like, oh, you know, cut this or move this there or whatever. When we started writing our musical together, she would sometimes sit at the piano and just start playing because we wouldn't know what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. And then I would just start writing. And it was kind of like, you know, like ad-libbing at first. And, you know, some of our greatest songs start from the most ridiculous ad-libbing, and then eventually we turn it into a great song.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's how the best songs come about, is that you just, you're not afraid to be silly, and you just kind of just start jamming.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, like when we're really rushed, I'll start writing lyrics, and then it will be like a factory. So she'll be working on the music to one song in one room, and I'll be working on the lyrics to a song in another room.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating.
Well, there's the music. We're out of time. Lori Rubin, her memoir is called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. Saturday night at 7 o'clock, she's going to be performing with Jenny Tyra, her solo show at the Promontory Amphitheater in Park City, accompanied by Jenny, of course. The concert is free, but you have to RSVP in advance. You can get all of the details on our website, radiowest.org. Lori Rubin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.